We are the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short. And this is ACAM Learn.
Welcome to Mind the Kids podcast from the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health. At the heart of today's episode, we try to answer a key question. Can the cycle of violence that passes from one generation to the next actually be broken? Today, I'm joined by Dr. Laura Gawler, a postdoctoral fellow at the Centre for Child and Family Policy at Duke University, whose research centres on parenting, parent-child relationship, and child and adolescent wellbeing. Published in the Journal of Psychiatry and Psychology, known as JCPP, Laura's paper titled The Randomised Control Trial, Fast Track, Multi-Level Intervention for Children with Early Emerging Conduct Problems Breaks Intergenerational Transmission of Violence Across Three Generations, draws on one of the most ambitious longitudinal data sets in the field. Laura traces how experiences of violence ripple across three generations using data from landmark fast-track randomized control trial data, which follows families from high-risk communities across the United States since the 1990s. What makes this research so compelling is not just what it reveals about how intimate partner violence and parent-child violence transmits across generations, but the genuinely hopeful finding that early prevention intervention can interrupt that chain entirely. It's a fascinating piece of research and I can't wait to hear more. So let's get started. Hi, Laura. It's lovely to be speaking to you today.
Thank you for having me today.
Great stuff. Right. So look, let's start with some introductions. So it'd be great if you could introduce yourself, maybe say a little bit about your research interests, and as an opportunity just to name check any collaborators or contributors to the paper.
For sure. So I'm Laura Gawler. I'm originally Italian, but I work in the US right now. And I work at Center for Child and Family Policy at Duke University in the United States. And my research interests, and I'm a postdoctoral fellow there. My research interests are parenting, parent-child relationship, child and adolescent mental health from childhood to late adolescence, parent-child relationship in the family, child adjustment and well-being in the family. For this study, I have the pleasure to work with several great colleagues and researchers at the center, such as, for instance, Dr. Rotenberg, who was in charge of running the analysis for the study that we are going to discuss today together, and Dr. Godwin, who was the one involved in data collection and organized the data set that we used for the current study, and the Conduct Problems Prevention Research Group, who are a group of great researchers who were the creators of Fast Track back in the 90s, so the creators of the intervention that we are discussing today. And among all the PIs of Fast Track, I work in particular with Dr. Lansford and Dr. Dodge. So these are the collaborators of mine.
Great stuff. So great team. So let's jump in. So be useful if we just kind of like provide some context and some kind of background. So the study is looking at early emerging conduct problems. So why were you kind of focusing on that? Why is that such a kind of critical kind of point in the kind of developmental risk, I guess?
Yeah. So I would start saying that conduct problems are among the most prevalent child maladjustment during childhood. So they are extremely important because they influence the lives of children and adolescents across their complete developmental period. So they can be defined as a consistent pattern of aggressive and disobedient behaviors. And we can think of examples, very practical examples, such as like lying to others, being aggressive, feeling and exhibit anger, stealing things, breaking stuff on purpose. And we know that some of these behaviors are normal in the first years of life of children. But the problem is when they don't go away as soon as the child like develops his brain more, or as soon as the child learns that it's not possible to steal things, or it's not socially accepted to be aggressive. But there are some children that still have that patterns of behaviors. And for them, we are talking about early emerging conduct problems. And why is it important to talk about it? It's important because they are at a higher risk of developing antisocial behaviors later in life. They are at higher risk of being aggressive. They might engage in risky behaviors. They might be at more risk for criminal actions later. They suffer more from mental health issues. So for all these aspects, it's kind of too important to intervene as soon as possible with these children.
Yeah, okay. So kind of like really difficult to manage within the family at the time, but also the implications for mental health and kind of like life outcomes. So you focus on intergenerational transmission of violence. So could you just explain, you know, what does that mean? It'd be really good if you could talk about the theory of that. And I love the way you kind of gave those kind of real life examples in your life. Last answer, if you could bring it to life with what that looks like on a kind of practical terms, that'd be great.
For sure. So intergenerational transmission of violence basically is a circle of violence starting in one generation and going from that generation to the others. So we can think of a chain of violence starting in the past, influencing the present, and being more likely to be transmitted in the future. So basically, we can think of people, and we have plenty of clinical evidence and research evidence of this. So people with a previous history of violence are at a higher risk to become violent with their children or become violent partners, or are at higher risk to be engaged with violent partners. So in this case, violence never goes away, never fades away. It stays within family for generations. And we need to do something about it because we don't want that violent actions might be transmitted across several generations, impacting future children and adolescents. And why is important? We know that can be a risk factor for dysregulated emotions, mental health issues later in life. They are traumatic experiences, so they are related to poor social functioning, to poor academic outcomes and academic functioning. So we want to kind of intervene as soon as possible to break this negative circle of violence.
Okay. And so what was this study trying to kind of build on in terms of the theoretical knowledge? What were you trying to test in relation to this generational transmission of violence?
Yeah, so the study had two main aims. The first one was to explore trajectories of two types of violence, which are the intimate partner violence, so the violence happening between the two romantic partners, and the parent-child violence, so the violence who has the child as the main victim. And we wanted to test the trajectories between three generations. We have a lot of studies in the literature exploring intergenerational transmission of violence with two generations, but we have data on three generations. So we have data on the grandparents that during the 90s were parents when we collected data. Then we have data on the current parents that during the 90s were children. And now we have data on the current children who are children nowadays. So that was the first aim. The second aim was to test whether intervention can disrupt these trajectories, whether participating in a multi-level preventive and multi-component intervention can basically stop this negative cycle of violence. And if yes, how and when? So these were the two main research questions that we had in this study.
Okay. And has there been have there been other studies that have looked at that across three generations, or was this the first data set that's kind of like enabled that?
Well, I don't know if I don't know all the literature, of course, like for sure, I guess there will be plenty of studies with three generations. But like from what I saw in the literature, we have a lot of studies using two generations and collecting data using like retrospective measures or asking people to remember what happened in their childhood or during their lessons, while we really have data reported by grandparents when they were parents, parents when they were children, and the current children. So we were able to kind of give this new perspective on intergenerational transmission of violence.
Yeah. And the actual fast track study itself, so my sense is that it's kind of those kind of landmarks in kind of developmental psychology. From a kind of a child family perspective, what did the program actually involve? You know, what would it have felt like to be part of that kind of intervention?
Yeah. So I would start saying that Fast Track was a randomized controlled trial. So it started with like selecting 55 elementary schools in different parts of the United States. And these schools were selected based on the characteristics of the neighborhood. So like there were neighborhoods that were high in crime and like poverty. And there was a screening process of several children based on reports from parents and from teachers. And then these children that were selected were showing early emerging conduct problems and were divided in two groups. One group was the control group, so was followed throughout the years, but did not receive any intervention. And the other group was the intervention group. So they were not only followed, but they also received intervention. And I'm making this like comparison because I think that we need to understand that we can talk about intervention effects because we have the control group that didn't receive any intervention, right? In terms of the things that were part of the fast track, there were a lot of active ingredients of the intervention that started in the elementary school and continued until the last year of high school. So it was a very long intervention. And families undergoing the intervention received activities focused on peer relationship, classroom relationship, parent-child sharing and communication skills. They were able to focus on interpersonal and intrapersonal skills. They received also academic tutoring. So there was a variety of activities for those children and those families. But overall, the main idea was that if we are able to intervene starting from early years, we can kind of increase their mental health help people to have a better life also later during adulthood.
So a really complex study to, you know, like in terms of the intervention being so kind of complex over so long and then this follow-up over the generations. So, you know, what were some of the challenges of carrying out that research over that kind of like longitudinal period?
Yeah, so for sure, I would say that two main challenges were present. The first one was to keep contact with the families, not only during the interventions, because during the intervention was more easy because they were following school, but like also later after the intervention, especially because some families moved around the US. So there was like a lot of effort from the research staff continue to collect information about these families over the course of the years, because like Fast Track started in the 90s and we are still collecting data now. So it's been a lot of time of following these families. And I would say that the key for overcoming this challenge was that the research staff was really able to build a trust and trustful relationship with families. So families seen himself as being really seen by research staff, as like consider themselves as being really part of something and really important. And then there were couple of tips that we used. So just for give you an example, we collected information about contact of families, not only from the family itself, but like we also used the friends, neighbors to kind of be able to follow the families. The families were moving around the United States. And this was one of the first, one challenge. The second challenge is that times change a lot from the 90s until now. So just another example, technology was not really a thing when we started collecting data. Now technology is one of like the mega trend that is impacting families all over the world. So at the beginning, we're collecting information about like the access to news through newspaper, through TV. Now we have information about like social media use, new technology, access to internet of the household, stuff like that, that in the 90s were not super important aspect. And another example is that at the beginning, Fast Track collected data using paper questionnaires that were shipped to families. Now we use Qualtrics, we use technology to collect data. So there has been, you know, the change. We basically needed to follow times and also follow developmental period of like families, because we started collecting data from kids, then we went to adolescents, then we went to adults. So we needed to kind of change measures to follow their life.
So it'd be really helpful if you could just kind of like give us a kind of like an overview of the kind of key findings.
So as I said before, there were two types of violence, right? Intimate partner violence, which I will call IPV, and parent-to-child violence, which I will call PCV. So the main findings for us was that IPV in the first generation was transmitted in the form of parent-to-child violence, so PCV, in the second generation. And this led to worse mental health in the third generation. So there was a chain starting from violence between the partners in the first generation, going into violence toward the child in the second generation, and now leading to worse mental health in the third generation. So this chain was very negative one, but was present only in the control group. What was very interesting for us was that there was a breaking of the intervention between these two types of violence, and the intervention really stopped the negative chain on violence across the three generations.
So did the research kind of suggest which, you know, how the chain was broken?
Yeah. So basically, we saw that for the control group, parent-to-child violence was mediating the relationship between intimate partner violence and the negative outcomes in the third generation. But for the control, for the intervention group, that path was not significant. So we might think that the breaking happened between the first and second generation, and then it breaked the role of parent-to-child violence in continuing the violence against the third generation.
And are these research findings in line with kind of like the kind of like wider research literature?
Yeah, they are completely in line. So they are kind of strengthening the idea that intervention might really help people and might really break negative consequences of violence. In a kind of way, similar way as we said before, the thing that are truly interesting about this study are two. The first one is that we had three generations data. And the second one is that we have the control group. So we were able to really see differences across between the two groups. So we were really able to test the effect of the intervention. I would say that another point that is very important to understand and to keep in mind while looking at these results, and that is that Fast Track was in a multi-level component, right? It had several active ingredients. So a future direction might be to kind of disaggregate the specific activities that family did to see which one, whether and if yes, which one was more important to breaking the chain. So for the moment, we use the fast track as a global intervention, right? So in the future, it might be interesting to see if there were certain activities that were more important for families.
Yeah, because I guess the intervention itself was incredibly expensive, operating on so many layers. So I guess there's a, you know, really wanting to hone in on what the active kind of like impacts and effects were from.
For sure, for sure. Like we know that in an ideal world, we could do preventive interventions involving both families and school and health practitioners, having several components, providing several activities to children. But in reality, we know that these kind of interventions are very costly. They are very hard to build in the first place and then to maintain throughout the years. So knowing which aspect is more important would be also helpful for future interventions, because then we can select a specific part and use them in different environments.
And was there anything that particularly surprised you? Were there any kind of like bits of the research that you kind of went, oh, I wasn't expecting that?
Yeah, kind of related to the types of violence. So we were expecting to find a domain-specific transmission between the two types of violence. So we were expecting to find that IPV was in the first generation was related to IPV in the second generation, and PCV in the first generation was related to PCV in the second one. What we found instead was that the transmission occurred from IPV to PCV. So we found basically that one type of violence in the past influenced the other type of violence in the present, which was kind of surprising. And basically, we think that gives us more idea and more proof that violence is such a complex phenomenon where it's very hard to kind of disaggregate the types of violence and the effects of violence.
Yeah, so not a direct linear kind of like one type of violence leading to another, but a much more complicated construct, I guess.
Yeah, for sure. We always need to consider that it's also very difficult in psychology in general to kind of focus on a specific aspect without looking at the others, right? So it is kind of similar to at the beginning when we were talking about conduct problems. There is always a variety of aspects that kind of play a part in mental health.
So I'd like us to think a little bit about, you know, the implications of the work. And you mentioned a little bit about the kind of like the future. So, you know, what does the study tell us about the nature of conduct problems and the kind of interventions that are kind of most likely to be effective?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so as we were mentioning before, I think that the study is saying to us is that we cannot target a specific aspect of child behaviors or child mental health without looking at the context and without involving the community surrounding the child. So when we think about the child, we always need to consider that the child is embedded in a wider context. Of course, the family, but also the extended family, the school, the community, the infrastructures that surround the child. So if we are able to build an intervention that put the child in the middle and create opportunities for the child to engage with other important and significant adults, this can have a real impact on the children's life. And another thing that I would add is that basically what the study is saying is that if we invest in the future generation, we are already working on improving the life of the future generations. So each intervention that we do now will have good outcomes now, but also in the future. So this gives us a lot of hope. At least gives me a lot of hope.
Yeah, it feels like a very hopeful study. And, you know, young people's lives are not kind of set, that there are lots of opportunities for kind of change, and that the people's outcomes are not predetermined. You know, it feels like it's very hopeful in its heart.
Yeah. So the idea that sometimes there is the idea that if you live in a certain environment, you are basically done. So like if you grew up in a difficult neighborhood, in a violent family, this means that you will be violent, you will have mental health issues, you won't be able to kind of exit the patterns that are already determined and are already stable and are already there for you. I think that what Fast Track does is that it gives hope that this is not true. So like we selected people that were at higher risk for severe conduct problems later in life, and they were showing early emerging conduct problem. And then we saw that their children are not impacted, but their parents' history now. So if we provide an intervention, if we follow these children, if they are they have the chance to be involved and to work on specific skills, they can break this deterministic aspect of, like, this deterministic idea of violence.
And with that kind of strength of evidence, what does the study suggest from a policy perspective? What does this kind of, you know, what does the study sort of like suggest would be the kind of, you know, the optimal sort of like time of those kind of early intervention opportunities?
I think it says that public infrastructure needs to be present for families and for children. It says that we need to intervene now for increasing the well-being of the future generations. So again, in an ideal world, we know there is the consensus among researchers and clinicians that the sooner we start an intervention, the better it is. But then most of the time we lack the facility, we lack the support, we lack the infrastructure to do it. So what we can learn from this study is that if we are able to invest in families, invest in school, helping the families, we can really make an impact on the lives of children and adolescents, not only now, but also in the future generations. So again, the earlier we start, the better it is in general. And then starting generations before, it's the top that we can aim for, right?
Yeah. So we're coming to the end of the podcast. I just wondered whether there is a central message from the study. If you were kind of like wanting clinicians, educators, policymakers to really kind of like understand one key thing from the study.
Mm-hmm. I think that the key message is that preventive intervention work, they protect future generations. So they break the chain of violence and they kind of act as a shield for people living in the future, not only for people living now. In terms of the questions that remain for us and for the field open, I would say that we should explore which component of the intervention were more effective, so we can kind of create and develop better future interventions that might be less expensive and equally effective as Fast Track. And this is one thing. The other one is that we always need to remember that while this intervention was very effective, it might not have been working for all children. So each intervention that we think about needs to start from assessing the needs of children, because there are some children, each children has his own specificity. So there are children that can be, that that can benefit more from interventions than others. So the key for clinicians and the practitioners and the policymakers is kind of like balance preventive intervention that we know are evidence-based and they work with the idea that each child has its own story and we need to like do a good assessment of this to kind of create the best intervention as possible for these children, which is like a giant challenge.
Yes. Yeah, indeed, indeed. It's been so interesting talking to you, Laura. If our listeners are kind of want to find out a little bit more about your work or the kind of like the field, are there kind of like resources or kind of websites or links that you suggest people look up?
So for sure, there is the Fast Track website, and there are plenty of publications about Fast Track, which has been a study like started in the 90s. So you could imagine how many papers, books, chapters, books are over there on the internet. So like if you type Fast Track Intervention Duke University, there is the website you can look at where there are all the measures that we used, all the research that were involved in the study, all the components of the Fast Track. So this is for sure a website that people should look at if they're interested in Fast Track. And then if they are more interested in like seeing my work or like the environment where I work at. CCFP, Center for Child and Family Policy, has its own website where you find events going on or you find like a spotlight of research that are conducted in the center. And we do a lot of interesting research, not only on Fast Track, but like we have longitudinal studies. So I mean, if somebody is interested in kind of understanding developmental trajectories of children and adolescents and their parents, CCFP is the right place to search for this information.
Brilliant. Laura, thank you so much for your time. It's been a great, really interesting conversation.
Thank you for having me.
That was great to be able to talk to Laura about her work. For me, the most powerful takeaway was the hopeful one. There's often talk about cycles of disadvantage and violence as though they're kind of like inevitable, that we kind of like end up predetermined. But what this study shows is that's just not true. When families receive Fast Track intervention, a chain can be broken. The intimate partner violence that shaped one generation didn't have to go on to define the next. And that's a remarkable finding, a remarkable piece of evidence. I was also struck by Laura's point about the complexity of violence itself, the fact that it was intimate partner violence in the grandparent generation that predicted parent-child violence in the next, rather than a like-for-like transmission. It's a reminder that these experiences don't travel in straight lines, and we need to reflect that in how we approach kind of like interventions and responses. So, once again, thanks for joining me. Do please subscribe where you get your podcasts. Sign up to the YouTube channel. Just search ACAMH and it finds us all across kind of like social media. So next week, we'll be speaking to Susan Swingler on a similar topic about violence exposure and adolescent conduct problems in high adversity setting, this time in South Africa.